This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Good evening, and to those of you I haven't met before, welcome to the Keynes Seminar. My name is Mark Hayes, the Fellow in Economics here at Robinson. And it's my great pleasure tonight to introduce two speakers, Professor Richard Werner, who will talk about the role of money in macroeconomics, followed by a response from Professor Victoria Chick. Richard Werner holds the chair in international banking at the University of Southampton, where he's also director of international development and founding director of the Centre for Banking, Finance and Sustainable Development, a very interesting mixture. A graduate of LSE and Oxford, he's worked not only in academia but in central banking and financial services. I understand he coined the phrase quantitative easing, of which no doubt we will hear a lot more later. Victoria Chick is Emeritus Professor of Economics at University College London. She's contributed in so many areas, but in particular to our understanding of Keynes's general theory through her book Macroeconomics After Keynes, which has been a formative influence on many, including myself. She co-founded with Philip Orestes in 1988 the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, of which this seminar is currently the physical centre. And I'm delighted that she's continuing this evening to make her contribution as actively as ever. Vicky's kindly agreed to give us an initial response to Richard's talk in order to set the discussion going. So over to you, Richard.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I would like to talk about the quantity theory of credit and some of its applications. There are a number of issues in modern macroeconomics which you could politely call open questions, or others may call it anomalies or puzzles, and some of them have become in much clearer focus recently in the aftermath of this North Atlantic banking crisis, but also particularly in the context of other banking crises. And some of these questions are things like, well, why are interest rates as a monetary policy tool actually not as effective as people thought they should be, or as theory says they should be? Why do we have these banking crises? In fact, banks, well, why are banks special? They're not supposed to be according to the mainstream theories. And of course, sort of probing further in that direction, more fundamental questions such as, well, what is actually money? How do we measure it? Turns out to be an open question as well in mainstream macroeconomics. Connected to that, the link between money and the economy, at one stage it was thought to be a fairly stable relationship, but that disappeared. And since then, there have been basically a lot of unanswered questions. The velocity decline is how it's sometimes phrased, or breakdown of the money demand function. There's further issues. I mean, the list could go on. I'm just trying to give you the core questions, which I will also try to answer. That includes what determines asset prices. In fact, this whole issue of asset markets and their link to the rest of the economy. But also, especially at a post-Keynesian seminar, we should think about fiscal policy. And that also may at times be less effective than anticipated. And in fact, there is recently, I think, an IMF, the World Economic Outlook, the IMF, raised the issue of the fiscal multiplier, which seemed to have been forgotten by a lot of economists, and suddenly it's back on the table. Now, they were saying the other way around, that especially when you tighten, suddenly the fiscal multiplier may be so large that this will worsen any fiscal tightening. And of course, that argument has been applied to things like the policies imposed on Greece and so on. So I will also try to address this issue of the effectiveness of fiscal policy. But let's start with the core sort of fundamental issues, because really you have to build things from there. What is money? How can we measure it accurately? How is it linked with the economy? There used to be much more certainty, especially until roughly the 1980s. It's still true to say that most macroeconomic approaches have particularly one framework for linking the monetary side to the real, the tangible economy, and that's the well-known quantity equation, which of course was used in classical economics. Each time there may be, you know, additional auxiliary assumptions, but the formula was not in dispute. It was also used by Keynesian economics, and of course used a lot, again, together with particular assumptions, by the monetarist approach, but also by the new classical approach, even the rational expectations models and real business cycles models, when they still had money in them. That was their preferred way of linking money to the economy. And of course, it's also in the post-Keynesian framework, whether it's Basil Moore or other post-Keynesian writers. Before the banking crisis, then, we saw actually a new development, which, I mean, of course it started earlier, but basically had come to the fore, what has been called the new monetary policy consensus, whereby the argument was made, such as by Michael Woodford, that money doesn't matter, any form of aggregate, monetary aggregate, is not interesting. It's all in the price. Of course, the price of money, the interest rate, always was also an important variable in previous macro approaches, but it seemed to have been sort of secondary to the quantity, although that really changed in the last 20 years, and the quantity of money or various monetary aggregates disappeared and became just the price of money. Central banks in particular seem to emphasize this in their descriptions of what they're doing in terms of monetary policy. Now, for most of these, well, in fact, for the approaches that use the quantity equation, a subsidiary assumption was stability of the velocity, which obviously was a residual, because otherwise we didn't really know anything about the link between whatever M is and the economy. And that's, of course, something that's been quite elusive since the 80s. Now, the conventional theories assumed effectively that the effective money, M times some kind of, well, velocity of circulation or income velocity of money, is represented well by nominal GDP. And this really assumes that the money is largely used for transactions that are measured or proxied well by GDP. So this formulation, despite this implicit assumption, was still called an identity, a truism by Milton Friedman, which is very strong, a strong claim. You know, an identity is not in dispute. It's true, as Hunter, monetary economics textbook, said in 2000, valid under any set of circumstances whatever. However, of course, since the 80s, it just didn't seem to work. When you try to check this empirically, of course, you've got to put data to it. Nominal GDP, we can get quite easily. Velocity is a residual, so we need M. That's, of course, where the problems start. How do we measure money? But even if you just keep an open mind and take almost any measure here, from M0, M1, to M2, M3, M4, none of them seem to give a stable relationship between the monetary side and the real economy, which is this phenomenon known as the velocity decline, or the breakdown of the money demand function. In a lot of econometric work, this has been recognized, particularly on the UK and the US. There's been lots of work in the 80s and 90s, but that's true also in many other countries, whether Asia, Scandinavia, or indeed various emerging markets. In an earlier era, the same phenomenon was actually referred to, and I quite like this expression, the mystery of the missing money. Because effectively what was happening is, I mean, how do you get a velocity decline? What does this mean? The M was rising a lot more than the nominal GDP. That's really what was happening. So, of course, velocity as a residual had to fall, because we've defined it as the ratio of nominal GDP to money. And here in the charts I show M0, M1, M2, it doesn't matter which one. Already the declines in the 80s were of such proportions that commentators and researchers wrote, this is a puzzling anomaly, a worldwide puzzling anomaly. Charles Goodhart had a very nice phrase on this. He said that this quantity relationship came apart at the seams during the course of the 1980s because whichever measure of money you chose, it wasn't in a stable relationship with the economy. So that was a big puzzle, a big challenge, of course, therefore, to all of these theories, all of these macro approaches. How did economists respond to this? They didn't provide an answer. Instead, they took the easier route of escaping from the issue. Suddenly, in fact, many people wrote at the time, we need a new paradigm, and there was a new paradigm being marketed, the paradigm of moneyless economics. And suddenly, there was no more problem, because we don't have money in there. We don't have a banking system in there. The real business cycle, moneyless versions, started to get very popular, and, of course, until the crisis, they ruled supreme in the DSGE version. So I think that these approaches have to face the criticism that they're a form of sort of intellectual escapism, because there was never any attempt to actually confront these problems, which is ignore money, was the response. But we can actually solve the puzzle, because if you go back into earlier versions of the quantity equation, such as Fisher and earlier formulations, there are many earlier ones as well, but Irving Fisher's 1911 is a sort of well-known one, we see that he's talking about transactions, and he's saying that the money times its velocity is equal to the value of transactions. Now, that's not the same as the version that's been used in the macro models, because the implicit assumption, of course, is that GDP is a good proxy, to be kind to this idea, of all transactions in the economy. Trouble is, financial transactions, asset transactions, are not part of GDP. And therefore, effectively, all these traditional formulations in all the macro approaches ignored financial transactions. Now, of course, we know, especially after the crisis where a lot of these data were highlighted, financial transactions can be much larger than GDP, a multiple of GDP. In fact, usually are, for economies such as the UK, a large multiple of GDP. So what are the implications? Well, if we want to have a more manageable version of Fisher's equation, money times its velocity is equal to the value of transactions, P times Q, and we want to have GDP in there, the only way to do this is to split money by its use into two streams. Because what is true is that money, the money used to pay for transactions must be equal for the value of that same set of transactions. And therefore, we just split money into two streams. Money that is used for GDP transactions, transactions that contribute to the value added that is measured by GDP, and money that is used for transactions that are not part of GDP, which are the financial transactions. Of course, this distinction would be nothing new to national income accountants, because they've thought about this, and there's a reason why the financial transactions aren't in GDP. GDP is a measure of value added. And financial transactions don't add value, is the implication. Well, to put it in slightly different terms, the GDP transactions are income-oriented transactions that generate income streams, whereas the financial asset transactions ultimately are capital gains-oriented transactions, and GDP is an income measure. So when you look at growth rates, what we find then is that the growth of money, subscript R, of course, for the real economy, GDP transactions, drives nominal GDP growth and determines it, and if we get good data, should be equal to it even. There's the growth in financial transactions determines, drives, and should be equal to the growth in the value of financial transactions. So this very simple idea of splitting the quantity equation into two streams already, on a theoretical level, explains a whole number of phenomena which you would then expect to observe. If you keep using the old quantity equation, when money is created, but is used largely for financial transactions, the old quantity equation must give you the appearance of a velocity decline, because it's basically not true that all money is used for GDP. So it wasn't an identity true at all times. Far from it. It was not true. And the velocity decline is the result of money being increasingly used for financial transactions which aren't part of GDP. And surprise, surprise, whenever we have a financial market boom, that's when we observe the velocity decline. And of course, the financial boom itself is explained because it's driven by money creation used for financial transactions. And it will rise and expand while you increase money for financial transactions. That's the red equation here. It's the bad stuff, and the green one is the good stuff. Shows, of course, when does an asset bubble burst? We can also tell from this formula. As soon as money creation used for transactions in the financial, the non-GDP part of the economy, starts to slow. Because the financial transactions, the financial circulation, is basically a Ponzi game. You have money creation driving up asset prices, which generates capital gains. In total, it's a zero-sum game. There is no value added, but it's a transfer from the, like any Ponzi game, from the late entrance, late entry, late exit, to the early entry, early exit people. Standard Ponzi game. So the Great Moderation was again an illusion created by this money supply growth expanding for financial transactions. And therefore, there was no inflation because money didn't go into GDP transactions. It stayed in financial markets, as we saw also in other places such as Japan, and where we had big and long asset booms. It also would explain why interest rate and indeed fiscal policy was not as effective as expected, because I don't notice interest rates being in this very simple two-flow, two-stream model. They're not a driving variable at all. Fiscal policy is also not in here as a causal variable. In fact, if you have, say, if you look at the green equation here, MRs are money for the real circulation. Say it's not growing. We have no monetary growth for GDP transactions. And we know there won't be nominal GDP growth, a recession. If in those circumstances you expand fiscal policy, government expenditure, to use the simplest example, that's a component of Y. And therefore, we know the total nominal GDP is not going to rise. That means there won't be growth, so the national income pie is unchanged. Growth is when the pie grows, but it's not growing because there's no monetary growth. If you then have fiscal stimulation, you're increasing the government share of the given pie. You must crowd out the private sector. This is not crowding out through interest rates. It's through the quantity of money. But I'll come to the details of this. This is sort of a preview of some of the conclusions. And of course, we also know why we have recurring banking crises. Because money creation in the financial circulation is a Ponzi scheme, always unsustainable, and it must lead to crises when it's large enough. Now, that's a nice theoretical idea. And to some extent, in slightly different context, actually, both Irving Fisher and Keynes and Friedman have said similar things. They haven't quite sort of done this split, but they talked about the idea, Keynes, for example, of the industrial circulation and the, call it, speculative circulation of money. Friedman said, you know, it'd be nice to split money into its various uses, if we could only do so. None of them did so because they thought you can't split money by its use. Now, I would like to assert that you can. How do you do that? Well, to use this empirically and actually apply it for anything, including policy, we have to now tackle the question, how to measure money. What is money? The textbooks tell us, oh, sorry, we don't know what money is. Maybe it's M1, M2, M3. It's all very complex these days. Deregulation, liberalization, financial engineering. The Federal Reserve even says in its publications, there's no definitive answer in terms of all its final uses to the question, what is money? We don't know what money is. It's another cop-out, I would say. I want to lead you to the answer, and of course some of you will know the answer. I think we should think about banks at this juncture. Briefly, you know how textbooks, if they mention banks, and the older textbooks do mention them, the newer ones don't. If they do, then they have usually the story that banks are financial intermediaries. They collect the savings from the depositors, and they, in fact, they're very sound intermediaries because there's a reserve requirement usually. Let's say it's 1%. There's £100 deposited with a bank. It will lend out 99 and give £1 to the central bank. It's a very solid financial intermediary. And therefore, it's indirect finance because it's an intermediary, direct finance, an alternative route through issuing bonds and so on. But banks are then ignored or neglected in the analysis macro models because they're not supposed to be special. So we can just have, instead of banks, something simpler. In fact, the whole financial sector can be substituted by the bond market. There'd be one bond market interest rate. That's usually how it's modeled. We don't need any more detail because banks are just like other financial intermediaries. They're just there. They do some stuff, but they don't affect things systemically. However, empirically, it's quite clear that this is not true and has been clear for a long time. Whether you go back to some studies in the 80s that found that banks have some kind of monopoly power compared to other financial institutions, or other work, say, by Ashcroft on what happens when banks go bust in America. There's thousands of banks, and there's always, even in good times, banks going bust. And studies have shown for a long time already that always has a macroeconomic impact. So what makes banks special is an open question. Well, let's look at what banks do. The main business of banking is to lend money. Now, the English language is quite precise on this point, actually. To borrow and to lend refers to the transfer of control of something. Vicky, if I borrow your pen, then you won't be able to write with it. So we've transferred control of this. If I borrow your car, you know, normally you won't drive somewhere else with it while I've borrowed it. So that's lending and borrowing. By this definition, there is no such thing as a bank loan. Banks don't lend money. They're not extending loans. What banks do is much more important and more powerful. And that is clearly something we need to reflect in macro models. What do they do? So back to this question, what is money? Where does it come from? A survey I conducted of about 1,000 people found that over 80% thinks the money comes from the government or the central bank, and that's fair enough as an answer, I think. But the fact is, only 3% of the money supply is created by the central bank, and usually zero by the government. So where do the remaining 97% come from? Who creates it, who allocates it, and how? And of course, I hope you know the answer, it's the banks. They have a license to create money. So they're not just financial intermediaries. They are the creators and allocators of the money supply, which is a crucial decision that obviously you can see will reshape the economic landscape in just a short time period. They do not provide loans. They create credit, which is quite different, clearly, in its macroeconomic implication. If you're interested, and you may, of course, be aware of this, but this is how it works, just to contrast this with a textbook story. So if there's a new deposit of £100 with a bank, increasing its bank balance sheet liability by £100, the reserve requirement is not an obstacle to the bank. The bank will say, fine, I won't just give the central bank £1 now out of these 100. I'll give them the entire 100. That seems silly, you might think. Well, actually, it's very smart from a banker's perspective, because they will then say, this 100 is my 1%. And now I can lend 10,000 minus the 100, 9,900. Of course, ex post looking at the calculation, that's fine, but how does it work physically? How is this possible? Well, it is bank regulation. Banks are allowed to do the following accounting trick. You come to the bank, and if I just may borrow again a piece of paper from you. Okay. Any of these were good. So let's say this is the loan contract. You've gone to the bank and you've signed a loan contract with all the details, how quickly they can foreclose on you and all that stuff. Interest repayment schedule. The bank is now quite astonishingly allowed to use this piece of paper that you've signed and put it on its balance sheet in a very strange way. It says, oh, well, I'll pick one thing out of this now, namely, you owe me money. You've just borrowed this, and you've signed that you'll repay it. You haven't even received it, but the bank will say, it's an asset now, because it's a claim I have on the borrower that they will repay the money in 10 years' time, 5 years, whatever. So the bank will put it on the asset side of the balance sheet, 9,900. The borrower will say, well, I don't care about the accounting. Please, can I have the money? And the banker will say, well, we've just opened an account for you with us. They may even say, we'll transfer the money to your account. That, of course, would be a lie, because no money is transferred. It's important to realize that no money is transferred away from anywhere inside the bank or anywhere inside the economy. The money is newly created, invented, as an entry into your deposit account. To balance the balance sheet. They've invented the asset on the basis of your contract, and now they needed the liability. And they take the other half of the contract now. So any other one, a non-bank, would not be allowed to do this by accounting rules. It would have to put it both on the asset side, you know, accounts receivable, and then when you pay out the loan, you reduce your cash balances, plus minus zero. You don't lengthen the balance sheet. That's why banks are special. They create the money supply. Of course, that is recognized, and therefore, I hope you will have heard this before. MacLeod, for example, you can go further back. I mean, there's Schumpeter wrote a lot about it. Keynes also, of course, as well. So banks create new money out of nothing. That's credit creation. That's how the money supply is created. Although at one stage, economists sort of seem to realize it, but then it's not reflected in their theories. And as Schumpeter complained, proved extraordinarily difficult for economists to recognize that bank loans and bank investments do create deposits. You probably won't need backing of this, but central banks do admit this, of course, usually in obscure places that are not highlighted and are not used for policy discussions, but they've all said it, whether the Bank of England, that the banks make loans that create additional deposits, or Federal Reserve or Bundesbank, the commercial banks can create money. So, how do we measure M? Back to this question. Well, it's created through bank credit creation. What does this mean for a quantity equation? The equation of exchange says that money used for transactions must be equal to the value of these transactions. Now, growth, if you look at it on a growth basis, it's more obvious. Growth means more transactions take place this year than last year. That means more money's been used for transactions this year than last year. In our system that we have, where the banks create money, that's only possible if more money has been created. So credit creation is the correct variable to put into the quantity equation, especially since it used to be a transaction equation. If you look at M, it should never have appeared there because this is money out of circulation, deposits, savings. But we want to measure money in circulation. Therefore, we have to look at credit aggregates. So we can now do what we did theoretically earlier on. We split the quantity equation into two streams, and money is credit, just to make this clear, call it CR credit in real circulation, CF credit in financial circulation, and of course the growth rates. And that explains all these puzzles, which is not a mean feat, just with this basic framework. And you can do this empirically. The velocity decline, if you take out the financial circulation credit, this is Japanese data. It was credit for non-bank financial institutions, real estate and construction firms. Take it out. The remaining credit gives you a velocity, credit to GDP ratio, gives you a velocity that actually has no trend throughout the 80s and 90s, whereas the standard one, of course, has this familiar velocity decline. we can now explain nominal GDP. Remember that sort of monetary aggregate targeting fell out of fashion because no monetary aggregate was in a stable relationship with the economy. Well, credit for GDP transactions is in a stable relationship with the economy for even tough cases like the Japanese GDP growth rate or the UK GDP growth rate. Of course, it's nice to do this econometrically with a very sort of high burden of proof, which is the general to specific approach in econometrics, where you have alternative explanations of nominal GDP in there to start with, interest rates, the usual monetary aggregates, but you also include credit for real circulation. You do the downward reduction, you drop step by step, the least insignificant, the variable that's least significant, the most insignificant variable, you drop it, you run it again, and so on, until all the variables that remain are significant, Henry method, and turns out interest rates drop out, the monetary aggregates drop out, only credit for real circulation stays in. That's, of course, strongest evidence. And Granger causality unidirectional from credit to GDP. And, of course, it's nice to read it off with pure eyesight. The black line is credit for real circulation. The pink line is nominal GDP growth. Of course, implications are, well, the Japanese 20-year recession is due to lack of credit creation, which is actually not very hard to change. And I'll tell you how one can solve that problem very quickly. Asset prices can also be explained, therefore, by credit for financial transactions. The easiest here is the property market, because we have fairly good property price indicators. And also, we know that land doesn't grow, so we can simplify, because there should be direct proportionality of credit for financial for real estate transactions and the real estate price. And again, you have your general to specific formulation. It's only this credit for financial circulation that explains the real estate prices, and Granger causality is from credit to property prices. The pink line here is credit for real estate transactions, and the black line is land prices. This is Japanese data. They had an earlier bubble in the 70s, which is very nicely explained. And of course, credit leads the property market. Now, what about this other phenomenon that we therefore should be able to explain, banking crises? Well, whenever credit for financial circulation rises and becomes dominant, you will, and is large enough, then you will get an asset bubble. And it's, as we said, it's a Ponzi scheme. When the music stops, there aren't enough chairs, and the banks are bust. And banks are quickly bust because they have usually less than 10% of their assets as equity. So you just need a 10% decline in asset values, and the banking system is bust, and that can happen very quickly. In Japan, you see here that credit for financial circulation, as a proportion of total credit, doubled from 1980, 15%, to 30% by the end of the 80s. While total credit, of course, also grew dramatically, but the share also grew, doubled in this period. So massive predominance of financial credit creation. What are types of financial credit creation? Margin loans, like in the 20s in the US, loans to non-bank financial institutions, real estate, various types of property-related loans, but also loans to CIVs, as we saw, hedge funds, M&A, private equity funds, and direct financial investment by banks. All this is money creation leading used for financial transactions, which will create these boom-bust cycles. And then, I'm sure you've, nowadays, this is fairly common. When I published this sort of in the 90s, people were perhaps less aware of this, but you know, the credit creation for financial circulation pushes the asset prices, corporate balance sheets improve, collateral values rise. You, of course, can borrow more money. Everyone gets optimistic. They have capital gains. The banks also increase their loan valuation ratio. It all seems very safe and sound. Everyone's making money. The whole positive cycle is there. But it's all entirely unsustainable. So it's very easy during the boom time to already estimate the extent of the damage. Just take the credit for non-GDP transactions and see how important it is for out of total credit, or whether it's growing faster, credit is growing faster than GDP growth. And then once credit creation slows, that's the end of it. That's the music stopping. They thought they're still dancing, but, well, there aren't enough chairs. And the first speculators, the latecomers, are the ones that go bust first. You have bankruptcies. Of course, the banks start to get more risk-averse, reduce credit further. The real economy starts not to get credit. Unemployment rises, demand falls, bad debts increase further. The vicious cycle. Banking sector basically being bust. In this situation, the downward spiral can go on and on and on. And in Japan, we've seen it for 20 years. We're now entering the third decade of basically a slump and deflation in Japan. So the cause of past banking crises is, in virtually all cases, speculative credit creation. So just a conclusion here. Credit split into these streams delivers some policy implications. The good credit is credit for productive purposes. That's non-inflationary. And that's stable and sound and will avoid banking and financial crises. You can do this even at full employment. So you can always expand credit creation for productive purposes. There's no downside. It is boring. The gains, the profits may be modest compared to the other bad credit, but it's stable and sound. Credit for consumption, of course, is unproductive, creates consumer price inflation. That's perhaps more obvious. Less obvious had been, certainly to central banks, it seems, credit for financial circulation, which creates the asset bubbles and banking crises, and is always unsustainable. So when you look at data, broad credit, the red line, compared to nominal GDP, whenever that's out of hand, out of line with GDP, you will have a bust banking system. And it's just a question of when credit slows sufficiently to end that positive cycle, turn into negative cycle. In Ireland, we had bank credit growth of 30%, way above nominal GDP growth. Then you know this must, by definition, be financial circulation credit. Therefore, you'll get a bust banking system. Spain, between 15 and 20% credit growth, it was clear that the banking system had to go bust. In Germany, during that time period, credit growth stayed in line with nominal GDP, therefore no domestic banking crisis. Of course, they also bought US, you know, toxic waste, credit-structured products, and some banks also went bust because of that, but there was no indigenous domestic banking crisis. Banks have a fundamental, pivotal role in shaping the economy. They don't consider the macroeconomic or social welfare when they create and allocate money, and strangely, nobody even told them when you create credit, you know, do it for the good type of credit and avoid the bad type of credit. Nobody's asked them to do that. They just said, maximize your profits. And it turns out the financial credit creation does that faster than anything else. So actually, you can't blame the bankers. They responded to the incentives we gave them. But bank credit creation is a public privilege. And the implicit assumption was, although it's never been made explicit, that this shouldn't be used against the public benefit. And therefore, what we need is we need to restrict credit for harmful purposes and encourage credit for productive purposes. Only that is sustainable. So policy lesson, how to avoid boom-bust cycles, very easy. Restrict credit, in fact, in the extreme, ban credit for financial circulation. Remember, we're not saying ban financial transactions. We're not saying ban speculators. No. In fact, you won't need to regulate them anymore. You just don't allow them to have access to bank credit, which is special and is a public good because that's money creation. But they can borrow money from anyone else. There's capital markets, allegedly super efficient, and non-bank financial, and so on. You know, let the hedge funds get their money there, but not from banks because they serve a public goods function of creating the money supply. But beyond that, we can, of course, intervene directly in shaping the economy through quantitative credit guidance. They call window guidance in Asia, Japan, Korea, China, Taiwan, which was actually at the core of the East Asian economic miracle. They focused on having credit for productive purposes. You get high growth, no inflation, what then was later called an economic miracle. The tool was also used, in fact, historically by almost any central bank at some stage. En cadrement du crédit in France, Credit Plafondierung in the German language countries, credit planning scheme, Thailand, India, and so on. Is this tool effective? Oh, it's the most effective tool in terms of bank regulation and the tool that has the best track record in avoiding banking crises. This is window guidance, quarterly loan growth quotas that the banks were not allowed to overshoot or undershoot. Press the button, you get the actual result 3 months later for that quarter. That was 3 months after the guidance had been announced. So it's been very effective. Now, the other policy conclusion is, okay, I'll just skip these. Well, people talk about a macroprudential policy. Perhaps in the Q&A we can talk about this. Basically, briefly, the Basel capital adequacy framework is not going to work. It ignores credit creation. You can ask for banks to have higher capital during boom times. That's not going to stop or prevent the boom. By definition, it's already there when you ask them to. So where does it come from? It's too late. But also, they will be able to raise the capital because they've created the money that will become the capital. It's not a constraint. Probably, if you don't want direct credit guidance, which I think is a good policy and is well justified in the economics of it, if you don't want that, the alternative is to structure the banking sector such that you have largely only those banks that will automatically only lend for productive purposes and don't engage in financial speculation. And these are small local banks. In Germany, 70% of the banking sector are 1,700 small-scale local banks not allowed to lend to anyone outside their small local area. And because they're small, they can't lend big. They lend to small, medium-sized enterprises. That's why the Mittelstand, the core of the German economy, is always well-funded. And there's worldwide successful exporters dominated by these small firms because of the small banking sector. And that avoids also bubbles. There hasn't been an asset bubble in Germany in the post-war era. Just one more thing. I hope we'll have in the discussion time to talk about this question, why the interest rates have been ineffective, because I've got lots of material on here, and how does theory deal with this, and where does this interest rate story come from? But also, now I just briefly, as a last sort of minute, I want to tell you very quickly, because it is very easy, how to end the recessions that happen after banking crises. Of course, there's no need to have a banking crisis in the first place, but once you have one, you can also quickly end it. These are policies I've recommended in Japan in the early 90s already. We need to expand credit creation for GDP transactions. We know from the simple framework. That's it. Well, how do we do this in practice? By the way, I called this because they told me at the Nikkei, where they had a big article in 1995 on this, and they told me, you can't use credit creation in the headline. Nobody knows what this is. Have a different expression. And I used the Japanese expression for monetary stimulation, monetary easing, and added quantitative. And so I called it quantitative easing, so the definition, as the article says, is an expansion in credit creation. The article also says lowering interest rates to zero is not going to work. Having reserve expansion is not going to work. It doesn't do any good to the economy. You need to expand credit creation. So how do you do that? Number one, the central bank can create credit directly through purchase of assets from non-banks. So the Bank of England did a better job than the Bank of Japan because Bank of Japan just increased reserves. No impact, useless. Bank of England was a bit better, but that's just one of the recommendations I made. You have to combine this with other measures, particularly measures to increase bank credit creation. And I want to just give you the two things the easiest ones. I mean, there's a whole gamut of things you can do, but the easiest is to, number one, get rid of the bad debts in the banking system. The central bank can do this at zero cost to society. I think it's criminal when governments bail out banks and the taxpayer has to come up with the money and there's lots of debt as a result. Ireland is bust as a result. It was a fiscal poster boy before. You can do this at zero cost. The central bank buys the non-performing loans at face value, transfers to the central bank, and they stay there. End of story. You've saved the banks. If they buy something, say these loans, they're worth 20, face value 100, the central bank buys them for 100. The banks, of course, are safe. The hole in the asset side of the balance sheet is gone. Haven't you transferred the problem to the central bank and it's got a loss of 80? No, the central bank has no loss. It has a gain of 20. And this is what actually central banks do, standard practice for central banks, when they do not want a banking crisis to create a recession, such as Japan in 1945. this is what it did, and there was no recession, although the banking crisis was much larger than in the 1990s. And also the Bank of England did it in 1914, when the banks were bust. It just bought the non-performing assets. Problem solved. Taxpayer didn't have to pay. And of course, Bernanke, who did hear my proposals in the 90s as part of the, and he did join this debate on Japan, seems to have listened more carefully, because he, that's his infamous toxic waste purchase operations to the tune of several trillion dollars. Well, actually, it's not tax money. So it just solves the problem at zero cost. So you combine this, this is my quantitative easing article, you combine this with, this is the last slide, here. You still need a, this alone won't be enough, you still need a policy to increase credit. And especially when you're, say, in Greece or Spain, and the ECB is not cooperative because they're pursuing a different agenda to put pressure on you to implement neoliberal reforms or to force you to give up fiscal sovereignty in order to become part of this new United States of Europe, you can still stimulate the economy. All you need to do is, Spain, Greece, stop issuing government bonds. Why are these countries still issuing government bonds? Well, how do we fund the public sector borrowing requirement? How do you roll over the old debt that becomes due? No worries. Why borrow from the bond market full of speculators betting against you, dependent on Moody's credit ratings, which are being downgraded and creating these vicious cycles? Borrow from the creators of the money supply. Borrow from the commercial banks in Greece, in Spain. And it turns out that the prime rate, which is the interest rate in the credit market that banks charge borrowers, is usually significantly lower than the interest rate in the bond market. I mean, look at Greece, of course, the bond yields are, you know, through the roof, but the credit interest rates is tiny. It's below 4%. Portugal, Spain, when that was at 7%, the interest rate in the credit market was less than half of that. Now, the savings of money is a minor thing. That's a lot. In Italy's case, billions and billions of euros. The main thing is you are creating credit. You kickstart bank credit creation. You will get 6 months later nominal GDP growth domestically, which is what we need to get out of this downward spiral. The ECB can't stop it because the banks actually are allowed to use these loans as collateral. These are loan contracts from the banks that are not tradable. That's why they can't be attacked by speculators. They're not tradable. Moody's downgrades, so what? You're allowed to keep them on your books. The bank's allowed to keep them on the books at 100. And they don't need capital according to Basel rules. Zero risk weight for lending to the government. It's beautiful. It works. I've had legal, actually lawyers and central banking law check this. It can be done. You just need the governments to be informed. It's very hard to get through. I've sent them letters. We need the, basically it's the prime minister level. Nobody else dares to do this. I've spoken to the head of the debt management office. He's read this. He said, oh, nice idea, but you know, my hands are bound. I can't do this sort of thing. You need somebody like the Prime Minister, maybe the Finance Minister, if they have the guts or don't work for Goldman Sachs, could do this, because you kickstart credit creation, you solve this problem of the link with the banking system being shaky and the government not being able to borrow money, and you get a recovery. Who doesn't like this? Well, bond issuance is the number one source of revenue for firms like Goldman Sachs. They get up to 2%, and we're talking billions and billions. And what are they doing for this? Very little. So that's the other recommendation. There's much more to it, and I hope we have time to discuss and go back to some of the issues, such as why interest rates are actually not as effective as theory makes them out to be. But thank you very much. Thanks for your attention.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Yes. Time, unfortunately, is limited,
yes.
So we can't cover everything we might like to. But if I could ask Vicky to give a
right,
response.
No, the first thing I have to say, and I'm sorry, Richard, is that Richard sent me 100 pages of text plus a book of 133 pages to read for this seminar, and I refused to do it. And I think that's entirely reasonable.
I didn't even know it was going to be sent to you, so I...
Well, whoever the discussant was...
I didn't know there was going to be a discussant, so...
Well, I think...
But Mark did tell me last week to send you something short, but unfortunately I only saw that this week because I've been travelling.
Nor did you send me the slides, which is why I was writing so much. So, I'm speaking off the cuff. Okay.
Which we all know you have no problems with.
Well, wait and see. But I do want to be perfectly clear with all of you that I haven't made the usual preparations and why I haven't made them. The first thing to say is that on the question of banks not lending money, I'm, of course, delighted. And there's this lovely book from the New Economics Foundation, which you weren't to know. I know the general outline of already. And if you have students who are trapped in the financial intermediary story about banking, give them this. It's really very good. Yes. Where does money come from? And it's available from the New Economics Foundation. The four authors listed here, of whom Richard is one. But if you just Google New Economics Foundation, you'll be in business. it is a very good antidote to the neoclassical understanding of banking. It's very clear. It's very useful to anybody who has befuddled undergraduates wondering how banks actually create money. The fact that we should have sorted that out a very long time ago. I mean, you mentioned MacLeod in the mid-19th century. There was Hartley Withers' wonderful book, which you didn't mention, and I do recommend, The Meaning of Money, published in 1907. And then there are Keynes and Schumpeter and all of that. And still, people really can't believe that banks do this, but they do this, you're absolutely right. So that side of the of what you had to say, I'm delighted with. There are other things which I find much more puzzling. First of all, this emphasis on the quantity equation. I would have thought that the quantity equation was pretty well buried by the general theory. As something for which there are many slips between cup and lip. This is chapter 21, where he shows very clearly the number of factors that have to be, the number of assumptions that have to be met if the quantity theory is to hold, and they are very stringent. Now, you didn't seem to have any doubts, you said, and I was amazed at this, pure Friedmanian statement, you can't have an increase in income unless you have an increase in the money supply. Well, chapter 21 is your homework on that one, I think. because you surely can. That being said, I mean, Keynes understood perfectly well that banks, in his phrase, hold the key between one level of economic activity and another. So bank credit creation is crucial, but it's a question of whether there are other factors which you have to take into account to make a serious theoretical statement, and I would say that there are. The other problem I have, it relates to the same area. In this proposal that you have to substitute the money supply with credit creation, because, as you rightly say, people don't take out loans unless they intend to spend it, there seems to me to be a logical problem. It's quite true that credit is spent, but not all spending is financed by credit. Some spending takes place by the transfer of assets, that is to say, by the movement of deposits from one account to another. and I'm sure we all experience that. Every time I pay my gas bill, I don't go to the bank and ask for credit. You know, they run down my deposits. So there's a logical problem here that's not reversible. All credit is spent on something, but not all expenditure is financed by credit. It's not a reversible logical statement, I think. And so both stashes of bank deposits and credit come into this question of expenditure. Furthermore, not all expansion of bank balance sheets takes place in the form of new loans. If a bank buys existing assets, that too will increase their balance sheets and increase the quantity of money. So there are a series of logical traps there, which I think haven't been explored and need to be explored. Now, the other questions that I have about the framework that you propose actually relate to the history of the discussion. I did, before I realized that I had 100 pages to read a few pages of your the first attachment. And what was the point that you made? I'm sorry, I forget.
The history, considering the history.
Let me go back to that, and I'll see if I can catch myself up here. You seem not to recognize that this question of separating expenditure on GDP and expenditure on assets was something that exercised economists quite a lot in the 1960s and early 70s. George Garvey, J.S. Kramer, people like that. Oh yes, the statement you made that this was you were the first to successfully do this separation. It's not true.
Together with the monetary aggregate.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this before.
Yes, well.
We have to look at that.
Have a look at that. So there is a longer history of doing these sorts of splits than
with
you,
credit.
Than that. No, with money. Then you make.
Well, money
you is make
deposit money. How do you split that?
Well, they. For example, one of these authors separated transactions in New York City from transactions in the rest of the country.
Oh, yes, I know. I've seen that, but that's different. I know.
All right. Well, all right. But it's nowhere there, and there seems to be no recognition that this kind of work has been done in the past, or any discussion of it. So this 60s literature, I think, needs to be brought out. Keynes also splits deposits into business deposits and personal deposits in the Treatise on Money. And as you said, also talks about the industrial circulation and the financial circulation. When we get to the general theory, then we have liquidity preference, which doesn't play a role in your framework at all. Liquidity preference, of course, plays a role in Chapter 21, but it is manifestly a question of the choice between money and other financial assets. It's not so obvious in the liquidity preference story that money is new money. But of course, when he goes on to talking about open market operations, then it clearly is. So that's a part of the story, along with Chapter 21, which doesn't seem to play any role at all. Or to put it in another way, to look at it from the other side, in more old-fashioned language, which you seem to favor, the question of idle balances plays no role at all. Now, Keynes could see the deflationary impact of hoarding, so could Dennis Robertson, so could Marx. And this would break the link that you make, the hard and fast link that you make between money and income. You also say that the rate of interest doesn't play a role, but the Cambridge version of the quantity equation with K was an equation which related K to the rate of interest rather systematically. And that seems to not to play a role in the theoretical framework that you suggest. These are the sort of theoretical problems that I see, of which I think the most serious is this question of logical categories which aren't reversible. But also, I think it would be useful if your theoretical framework acknowledged some of the older literature of which this could be seen to be a part. Now, the only little bit of policy that I want to remark on, and not particularly develop, you said no one told the banks to lend for productive purposes. Well, this isn't true in England after the war, and during the war, of course, but for a long time after, credit direction was done extensively.
I meant, obviously, the recent period after the 80s.
But you didn't say. So, and you took examples from other countries, but not from here.
I'm referring to this recent banking crisis.
Yes. I think it's very important that a certain amount of knowledge of these things has been lost. And if you could bring that up, I think that would be a useful adjunct instead of starting, as it were, in 1995 or something like that, to go back and say these policy elements have been lost to us and should be recovered.